For the week of June 30th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 453, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Lisbon, Portugal, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
Oh, sure. Throw that in my face. I could have said in Atlanta, Georgia, or Stuart, Florida, or Tampa, Florida, but no, because you waited so long for us to do the show. I have to say, in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
Ah, you returned back to one of your many home bases.
That's right. That's right. One of my multiple home bases. And you're in Portugal, but literally the glamour of podcasting, you're sitting on the floor of a hotel room shoved between two beds.
Correct. Yes, I am. Yes, correct. That is true. I feel like one of those guys from CNN, mm-hmm. you know, that has to cover, in remote locations. I feel like one of those guys. Yeah, it would have been really great if I could remember those guys, the scud stud,
right, you're going to wear a flak jacket while you do the podcast.
Right. Exactly.
So are you a business in Portugal or is this pleasure?
Business and pleasure. I attended Cine Europe in Barcelona for a week, and now I'm here in Lisbon, Portugal.
Well, we don't have Cine Europe in our show notes. Any takeaways?
No, not really. One of the big takeaways was everybody seemed to really love Gemini Man. The footage that was shown of Gemini Man, liked.
I fell asleep during the trailer. I thought it was really boring.
Oh, okay. I don't know what to tell you.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that's cool. But the general mood as far as exhibition, are they feeling confident, good, or better than usual, or just things are the same?
Things seem to be the same as they were, say, at CinemaCon. That's for sure.
I mean, they're coming off the highest grossing worldwide box office of all time. That does not have them feeling, yay!
Yes, but like everything in life, or at least in this business, what have you done for me in the last 5 minutes?
Well, tell me, what are you going to do for me in the next hour, or really hour and a half, because we've got 3 weeks of news to catch up on? What's going to happen in the show?
This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're keeping an eye on the Writers Guild Association and their battle with talent agencies. Major talks stalled. One-on-one talks, well, they never got off the ground. Everyone is suing everyone, and now there's a new bombshell. We'll explain what that is. In the Middle Kingdom, aka China, the clampdown on content in movies just got a lot stricter, and the Chinese film industry is reeling. Who's benefiting from all this? Well, guess who? Hollywood. In sexual misconduct news, screenwriter Max Landis and director Bryan Singer are paying a price for their alleged actions, but they can take heart in Mel Gibson's return to favor. So I guess time heals all wounds, or at least time and money heals all wounds. On Inside Baseball, we'll be talking about Universal Music. The New York Times delivered an in-depth investigative piece about a massive fire at Universal Studios in 2009 that it says wiped out hundreds of thousands of invaluable masters by legendary recording artists. Universal poo-pooed the fire at the time, saying, it was nothing was lost. Don't pay attention to that.
They poo-pooed it.
Yes. Okay, but there's nothing to talk about. Well, they continue to insist that's the case, but the sale of a chunk of Universal Music has been delayed, artists are clamoring for more information, and the first class action lawsuit has already been filed. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, or in this case, the last 3 weeks' top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office, not just the weekend's box office, the entire week.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world and for the entire week. We've been doing this for weeks now, and it's really been kind of revelatory. When you look at the entire box office for the week, it paints a very different picture. We know that Disney is dominating the worldwide box office, but if you look at the last 2 months, there have been a string of number one movies from different studios and exhibitors. But the truth is, when we look at the worldwide box office every week, for every movie, for every day, it paints a very different picture. Aladdin has been the number one movie for 4 weeks in a row. Now Toy Story, a new Disney film, has been number one for 2 weeks in a row. It beat substantially by a country mile, Spider-Man Far From Home. No surprise, because Toy Story 4 is in 46 countries and Spidey is only in three. Right? Spidey's
well, you
doing
know,
great.
Actually, when you look at the whole week, if you look at just the weekend, let's face it, Toy Story 4 won, right? But if you look at the whole week,
if you look at the weekend, Spidey won worldwide.
Oh, worldwide. Okay, I see. Yeah, worldwide, Spidey won. And if you look at the weekend, yes. But if you look at the whole week, you've really, really stepped on my punchline here. The joke was that if you look at the whole week, Men in Black International won.
Yeah. No, that's one of the losers. But, you know, again, the worldwide box office chart, it's not a race. It's not a competition because you are comparing movies, some in three territories, some in 40, some in 60 or 80. So it's all apples and oranges. Each individual movie is what matters, how much they cost and how much they ultimately make. That's what we always emphasize on this show, as well as looking at worldwide box office. And you look, 8 of the top 10 movies are big hits. I think 12 of the top 15 are hits. So you're looking at a lot of successful movies here. Some out of the box, huge hits, and some not. But when you're going to look at the grosses, it makes no sense to look at 6 days of grosses from Annabelle Comes Home, which opened up on Tuesday in North America, and 4 days of grosses for Spider-Man, which opened up on Thursday in China and other territories. So we're looking at the total box office gross for them, but only 3 days for Toy Story 4, only 3 days for Aladdin. That doesn't make any sense. So we're looking at the full weeks. So here's what happens. We're looking at box office around the world, and this week the number one movie is Toy Story 4. It made $258 million worldwide, and it is at $500 million and counting. It's been the number one movie 2 weeks in a row. Next week it's going to be the movie that's at number two, Spider-Man Far From Home. It opened up on a classic midnight screening in the United States, not Canada, but in the U.S. they had a single midnight screening. Just to get things rolling because of the holiday weekend and when people are traveling. Lots of strategic reasons for that. But Spider-Man Far From Home opened up last night here in North America. But over the last 4 days worldwide, it grossed $111 million. So next week it'll be number one. The week after that it'll be the number one movie in the world. And then comes Disney's The Lion King. So that's
which will basically be the number one movie of all time.
It's going to be a big hit. They're making crazy money on these live action adaptations of their classic animated movies. So,
you know, I would say, you know, at Cine Europe, you know, they were faulted. Disney was faulted at CinemaCon in Las Vegas earlier in the year for basically putting on a presentation that was very stifled and kind of arrogant.
Like, yeah, you need our movies.
Right. Here's our movies. Good luck. But this time they here at Cine Europe, they had a little bit more time with Fox on board because remember at CinemaCon, that was like, you know, the merger had only happened 10 days prior to CinemaCon.
That's right. They barely had any time to fire people yet.
Yes, that's true. And now they've really done quite a job of that. But that said, at Cine Europe, they had a much more robust presentation. Although I have to say, and I'm speaking for myself personally, maybe it's because I already know the storyline of The Lion King. They showed some extended clips of The Lion King, and I was just like, eh.
It's almost a shot for shot, but it's done huge pre-sales in
Fandango. Oh, it's going to be enormous.
It's going to be enormous.
Totally.
But it's utterly pointless on a creative level. Utterly pointless. And I do worry that long-term they might damage some of these brands. But that's a silly thing to say when you've got Aladdin moving in on $900 million worldwide. So the number one movie is Toy Story 4, $258 million last week. Spidey grossed $111 million, a great $97 million alone in China. Annabelle Comes Home, the horror flick, opened up on last Tuesday. That grossed $65 million in its opening week. It's the seventh film in the Conjuring franchise. Some people wanted to pretend it didn't do great. No, it's doing just fine, and there are three more on the way.
So let's see. It's up to $65 million. It had a $30 million budget. Yeah, it's doing just fine.
At number four is Aladdin. That made $64 million worldwide last week. It's now again at $875 million. This one is going to blow past $900 million. It might darn well get to $1 billion unless maybe Toy Story and the momentum of The Lion King cut the legs out from under it. So unlike Avengers, we won't predict that we'll get to $1 billion, but it's still doing great. At number five worldwide is our first movie that we can consider a flop. It's Men in Black International. It grossed $37 million last week. It's falling hard and falling fast pretty much everywhere. It's at $220 million worldwide. They're not gonna be disastrously down on this movie, but they certainly are not rebooting the franchise.
Yeah, no, I mean, they might squeak by with breaking even theatrically only. Remember,
I don't think so. I don't think they'll get to 310 but or 330, but you know. Of course, our numbers are based on broad ideas of what they might have cost the studio to make. We don't have access to the actual budgets. They like to play games about, oh, this movie was made on the cheap. Oh, that movie was lavishly expensive. We don't know what the P&A cost is. And by the way, do we say P&A anymore? We don't, right? Because there are no prints.
Right, but you still say P&A. It's just, you know, kind of
it's an archaic term that will just go into the future, and they'll have to explain to the kids what it actually meant.
Correct.
At number six around the world is Hayao Miyazaki's classic Spirited Away, which finally got...
Michael, I think you have the wrong paper in front of you, because that must... That's a paper from a long, long time ago.
No, this is finally being released in China. Finally, people can go to the theater and see one of the great animated... Forget animated. One of the great films of all time, Spirited Away. It grossed $30 million this week in China. It looks like its total is about $81 million this go-around for the movie worldwide. That's basically the only territory it's in. So when you look at the worldwide grosses for this movie, which previously had jumped up to about $275 million, we're looking at a worldwide gross of over $350 million for a classic hand-drawn film that cost about $19 million to make.
Yes, I believe it's the only film with a talking daikon.
At number seven is another animated flick, not doing very well. The Secret Life of Pets 2, it made $29 million last week. It's at $225 million worldwide. So yes, it's going to triple its modest budget of $80 million. But when you look at the, what was it, $900 million that the first movie made, this one is clearly a disappointment. Not financially, but again, in terms of thinking, we've got a franchise. No, no, you don't. Though I imagine now they'll turn it into a TV series. And number eight is Yesterday, the Danny Boyle flick about a world in which only one guy knows the Beatles songs and he makes a career out of it. Clever idea. I actually want to go see it. It had a great opening week, mostly in the US and the UK. $25 million, which is exactly what it costs to make. But this one is going to have great legs because it appeals to an adult audience. It's going to run and run and run, just like Rocket Man.
You know, Danny Boyle, the director of this movie, said, if you think the idea for this movie is crazy, he agrees with you. In fact, when his agent sent him the script and when the producer sent him the script, he was like, why am I reading this? This is the stupidest idea.
Because we can't get it made. That's why it's stupid. Not because it's not a clever idea, but because you literally think, well, we'll never get the rights.
Well, he was like, I'll read the first 10 pages. I'll put it down. I'll say I'm not going to do it. He read the first 10 pages. He was like, oh my God, I want to make this movie. Like, the first 10 pages.
Director touts own film.
But no, in a way where he's like, yeah, no, this sounds like the worst concept on the face of the planet. And yet it's actually really good.
No, I don't think it sounds like a bad concept. It just sounds like a concept that you can't get made. It's like being John Malkovich. You go, well, but if we don't get John Malkovich, what do we do? At number nine around the world is Godzilla, King of Monsters. Another flop for sure. $24 million on the week. It's at $375 million worldwide. But I'm putting a question mark by that because the worldwide grosses for this movie have sort of stalled. They're either correcting some figures that got ahead of themselves or something. I'm not sure what's going on there, but there's no question it's well below the $500 million it needs to make just to break even. At number 10 is another big hit, though, John Wick 3. I was at a wedding over the weekend, and all the men talked about was John Wick 3. The ones who saw it were telling the ones who hadn't, you have to see this, dude. This movie
And they said it just like that.
Just like that. $14 million on the week. It's at $300 million worldwide. And here at number 11, we made news, Sperling.
Very How was that?
Obvious, easy to predict news. We said, well, clearly they want Avengers Endgame to top the worldwide charts for all time. They'll probably re-release it with some footage. And yes, that's exactly what they did. They put it back in theaters with some new footage, a kicker, an intro, so all sorts of fun stuff. It grossed $12 million. It's now at $2,761 million. It needs $27 million in order to become the highest grossing film of all time. But Sperling, this should warm your heart. CJ Flynn reached out to us via Facebook, and he said, yeah, but what about adjusting for inflation? If you adjust for inflation, then Avatar is well beyond Avengers Endgame, and he's right.
Did you just say that CJ Flynn reached out to us via Facebook or Spacebook?
Facebook.
Oh, Facebook. You mean facebook.com/showbizsandbox?
That's right. Spacebook is part of Space Force, and I'm not a member of that group yet.
Okay.
And number 12 is the Elton John biopic, Rocket Man. He's got a new song in that movie, and it's going to compete for the best song with the song he probably wrote for The Lion King. So he'll probably be competing with himself at the Oscars. But Rocket Man has been a monstrous hit. $12 million last week. It's at $165 million worldwide. It's quadrupled its budget. It'll probably get to at least $200 million. It may be a player come award season, but it's got a great long shelf life. So this movie is a big hit. Anyone who compares it to Bohemian Rhapsody is a moron.
Yeah, they're just two biopics.
That's right, exactly. Child's Play is chugging along. That's at $30 million worldwide. Dark Phoenix is one of the final hits we'll look at that is a movies that we should look at that is a flop that has really fallen hard and fast. $11 million this week. That's at $244 million worldwide. That's not going to come within a country mile of profitability. Unlike Parasite, the Palme d'Or winner, which is still doing great in Korea. I can't wait to see this film in the fall. And another flop to mention is Anna. This Luc Besson film opened up last week. It's the worst opening film of his career. It will certainly be the lowest grossing movie of his career. It's made $4 million this week. It's at $8 million total. People are running in the opposite direction. We'll have to see if he can recover from that. But that brings me to a comment people made about Late Night. That's the film starring Mindy Kaling, which she wrote, and Emma Thompson. It was released by Amazon, who picked it up for $13 million at a film festival. And it's not done great at the box office, certainly not up to their hoped for expectations. And the reports in the press said Amazon is staggering after its Late Night flop. When one of their top execs left, they're staggering. They don't know what to do. Clearly, they're trying to figure out the formula of how they go back and forth between putting some movies straight to streaming, some movies just a small limited release, and some movies getting a wide commercial release. You know, that's a new company. But I don't know your thoughts about this. My thought is, if one movie costing $13 million leaves you staggering, you've got a lot of problems.
Well, I think that, remember, they have started to distribute their own movies. Previously, they had, you know, they would pick up movies, but then give them to, say, Lionsgate or Roadside Attractions or, you know, Paramount to distribute. They would partner on these. So they're learning a new skill. And frankly, Late Night is a great movie, and people should be seeing it. It's hilarious. Now, was it worth $13 million?
But I would point out, it's their second highest grossing theatrical release of all time, which doesn't tell you it's a big success. It tells you, you know what? They haven't done a lot of this. They're just starting to release. They have Manchester by the Sea, right? Isn't that Amazon? That's their number one.
Yes, that was Amazon, but of course they did not release that.
No. Films that
they own a part of.
Yes, it's okay, their movie. Okay. That's how few movies they've actually had released by anybody. They're not doing much of this. This is brand new to them. So they have a very small track record. So no, they don't know what they're doing necessarily. Maybe they'll learn something from this movie. But for $13 million, I assume they have worldwide rights, or they've sold it off into other territories. Or guess what? If they made it for $5 million directly for their website, it'd be considered a big success story, especially if it won an Emmy. So
this would be huge. I think this is the kind of film that will be huge on their platform.
Exactly. So I don't think we can consider this a lot. Not that we'd say, oh, well, theatrical is just gravy. No, that's not the case. We're not going to let them off the hook. They may should have gotten more money out of this movie, but they'll learn from it. And they're so early in the game, it's crazy to draw big conclusions like, oh, they're staggering for a lot of reasons. If nothing else, their size. They are not staggering from this movie.
But this is what happens when you try and pick up a film like Late Night at some, you know, at an event like, yeah, with at Sundance, when you have, you know, you probably had Fox Searchlight in there, although maybe not Fox Searchlight since they were in the middle of an acquisition, although they actually picked up films, so maybe not. So when you have like two, three, four different companies bidding up a film and it winds up selling for $13 or $14 million, and you're like, well, that might be all that movie can make theatrically. Well, guess what? That's actually correct. That's all that movie could make theatrically, even if it cost, I think it costs like $5 or $6 million to make. Okay, great. Here's $10 million. It'll make $13 million.
I wouldn't have picked $13 million as the upper extreme for that movie.
Yeah, well, not with Emma Thompson in it. I mean, this is a movie that should be doing better than it is.
Right. $30 million was a reasonable expectation, and that's just North America. Whether they decide to keep it in-house worldwide or whether they decide to sell it off in other territories, there's money to be made that way as well.
Yes, I agree.
So we know what the U.S. box office is doing. Sort of, how's the box office going in China?
Well, I would say, you know, if you had to, you know, use math to figure it out, I'd go with down 2%, maybe even 2.9% during the first half.
And the first half of Chinese box office is more like our second half, right? Where you have the Christmas,
you have all of summer
for
us. Yeah, I mean, you have Christmas, Thanksgiving, and summer in the second half of our years, whereas for China, you have all of those early.
They have their Chinese New Year. Some of their biggest box office dates occur in February and March. So
right,
it really
exactly.
means that, nothing.
Thank you.
They cannot make up in the second half as easily as the North American box office can. So they are down. But guess what? Their revenue is down. Chinese films are down even more. But Hollywood movies at the Chinese box office, they're up 14%. Because as you and I have been saying over and over again, now they've got all these screens, they need content. Hollywood is going to come busting in because those exhibitors need movies to show. And that's what's happening. The Lion King, Spider-Man Far From Home are being shown right in the heat of the summer season. So it's a perfect storm really has battered the Chinese box office and their films in particular. There was the tax corruption crackdown. There's been increasing censorship, which we'll get to in a second. And there's the uncertainty of the U.S. trade war. So none of that has helped. But we can't point at them and laugh because the North American box office is down 9%. Maybe China will pass us just because they fall less slowly than we, you know, they'll fall slower than we do. We'll go back down past them.
Well, what I would say is in 2018, I mean, if you're comparing year over year, of course, you're going to be down. You had two mammoth films in 2018 open in the first half. And that is you had Black Panther and you had Avengers Infinity War.
And we had Captain Marvel and Avengers Endgame.
Yes.
Two massive hits.
Massive hits. You didn't have a, you know, it wasn't a what? How much did Black Panther make?
In North America, I don't know, like $300 million or something, or $600 million, something extraordinary.
Yeah, I don't know what the comparison is between Black Panther.
But you're
and
focusing
Captain
on two
Marvel.
Movies. That's not the point. Last year was the highest grossing year in box office history for North America. If we end up being down from the biggest year of all time, if we're the second highest grossing year of all time, only a fool would say, "What a disaster." What matters is how many movies you release. How much money did they cost? What did they make? And overall, is the industry robust? And coming off a peak year, you can't have every single year make more money than the year before. That's absurd. So if we're down a little bit, so what? If it's the second highest grossing or second biggest ticket selling year of all time, that's a great success story.
Well, you know what I would say, right? I mean, the most important figure there is attendance.
Right. Yeah. Ticket sales, we care. And that's down 7%, which makes sense because box office is down. They're not making up attendance with huge new numbers because people are stepping away more and more from 3D. Did we hear a word about 3D for Toy Story 3, a 4? No, not a word.
Yeah, no, we didn't hear anything.
Or premium screens? No, because I wouldn't pay extra for that. But so how do we help the box office? Are subscription plans the answer?
I don't know. I don't know. Look, you know, really, subscription plans probably, if you're an exhibitor, they help out the exhibitor more because they're the ones getting all the breakage, right? It's,
but they got to pay for the tickets.
They have to pay for the tickets, but if they were losing money on them, then they would say that they would probably stop them.
Of course.
So they're not losing money.
Right. So AMC has done it for a year now in the North American market. And now Regal is getting ready to launch at the end of the month its own plan. We don't have all the facts and figures yet. We'll wait till they do. But it looks to be roughly the same with maybe a few tweaks that aren't as appealing to me.
Are you going off of the Deadline article?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Is that BS?
I reached out to Regal when the information was leaked on Reddit and they never got back to me. You know, nobody there got back to me. So
you're saying
I don't know.
This Deadline article is ahead of the curve, maybe jumping the gun a little bit.
Yeah, because they said
it makes
sources,
sense that they would launch it in a slow season though.
Really? I don't know whether, you know, the Reddit information is correct or not. I guess we'll find out.
That's the only source that they had, basically. They were
vague. Well, it's exactly the same information.
So maybe there's a big thank you for pointing that out. What the question I have is they've been doing it in the UK for ages. Why haven't they launched one?
Oh, you know, I can tell you that actually, because I've talked to Cineworld about that, and I've talked to the people at Regal about that specifically.
Well, please do. It works well in the UK. Why aren't they doing it here?
Because in the UK, it's a more homogenous market. You have fewer, a smaller population that is less economically diverse and with ticket prices that don't vary as widely as they do, say, from Topeka, Kansas to Manhattan in New York City. So
$9 to $18, yeah.
Right, exactly. So that's part of
the problem. But you just do it regionally. It's not hard to figure out.
And that's exactly what they're going to do.
But
that
I mean,
is exactly
that hasn't taken them 10 years to figure out. They've been doing this for a decade or more in the UK. I don't understand. If it's working, and you're happy with it, why haven't you done it already?
Because
answer the question that, well, we got to figure out that maybe people in Oklahoma don't pay the same price for their plan as people who live in Manhattan. That ain't hard to figure out.
Well, I think they're also, at least Regal, they are just now kind of, they've only been purchased for about, 12 to 15 months by Cineworld. So they're just now coming up to a point where they can start pulling off initiatives.
Well, so, the U.S. box office is down, but it's compared to the biggest grossing year of all time. The Chinese box office is down, also compared to their biggest grossing year of all time. So we'll take a wait and see. And if at the end of the year we're down 5% or 8%, or we're the second highest grossing year of all time, keep that in perspective, folks. But China really does have some issues with censorship, don't they?
Yeah, they do have some issues with censorship. They had two movies about to be released, and they got pulled mainly because the Chinese government and Chinese authorities said, wait, this movie's about what? And at least one of them was about Chinese history, but the wrong Chinese history, the wrong kind of Chinese history.
Yeah, last episode we discussed how the Chinese government was letting the entertainment industry know its recent crackdown on content and tightening control over the biz was the new normal. And it didn't take long for the government to prove true to its word. The Shanghai Film Festival is a key cultural event, of course, for the Chinese film industry. But at the last minute, the opening night film called The 800 was yanked from the schedule. It's an epic World War II film depicting the celebrated sacrifice of Chinese soldiers defending the city of Shanghai from invading Japanese soldiers. Remember, Japan occupied China. Some historians say World War II began in the late 30s before, the European conflict. With China and Japan. Anyway, you could call it the Chinese Dunkirk. That's how inspiring it is, since hundreds of Chinese soldiers, civilians, and deserters banded together to hold off the Japanese while the main army headed away so it could regroup and fight again. It's the first Chinese film shot almost entirely in IMAX. It cost a reported $80 million. And some speculated the fact the film is about a Chinese defeat is one reason the 800 was unexpectedly blocked. Plus, it's an historically accurate film, which means the heroes are basically member of Chiang Kai-shek's army, not the Communist Party's army, which, of course, were battling each other for control of China. So, most of the soldiers in this actual real event ultimately ended up in Taiwan because they fled China to go to Taiwan. Or if they stayed, they suffered during the Cultural Revolution. So it's a historic battle that China loves to celebrate. They just don't want you to think about it too deeply. And now that they yanked it from the film festival, and then they yanked it from its release just days before it was to open up for the public. The same thing happened to Better Days, which was yanked from Berlin. And then a few days after The 800 was yanked from commercial release, it too was canceled for technical reasons, which left the door wide open for Spider-Man Far From Home. All these people who were going to have a local movie as an option suddenly said, well, I guess we'll go see Spider-Man Far From Home. So I really
What I don't understand is how it's the Shanghai Film Festival.
Yes.
It's in China.
And it's a Chinese movie that you approved and it cost a ton of money. Surely you knew what the battle was about. They approved the script. We know there's always these internal tussles, but there's no excuse for a Chinese big budget movie being approved, being made, set up to be the opening film at your own film festival, and still you have this disastrous nightmare. And it's really shaking people in the industry. They're like, what the heck? We do everything that we're supposed to do, and we still get screwed in the end. They really are worried about the cultural and creative health of their industry and not knowing, tell us what to do and we'll do it. That's the problem when you have no idea what to do, and that's what totalitarian governments depend on. Just that fear of not knowing what to do. Today you're supposed to do this. Okay. Tomorrow do that. Okay. But it's really hard and scary when you're trying to make...
That was one of the first things the MPAA and NATO said to China and even to Saudi Arabia, although we're not going to walk down that road right now, was you need a way, like if you're going to censor films, you got to tell people like what the rules are. You need a rating system of some kind so that people know what's out of bounds.
And they said the rules are what we say the rules are at any particular moment.
Yeah, write that down because that's the rule, except when we say it's not the rule, which might be tomorrow or in 5.5 minutes.
So there's a lot of turmoil in that industry. There's also perhaps turmoil, is that the right word, in the Hollywood industry because of the ongoing battle between the Writers Guild Association and the the talent agencies.
I got to tell you, Michael, I have not been able to get my agent to call me back for weeks, months now. Also, I don't have an agent, so that's probably why.
But I'm pumped. Yes. So I don't know if we can say it's really hurting business yet, because people keep saying, well, we've booked our shows. We've got our team of writers. We had no problem. I had no problem. We can imagine long-term problems for young writers, especially. But movies are being made. TVs are being made. But this is a big battle. What's the latest?
Well, okay. So the latest I know is that Abrams Artist, they agreed to the terms, the new, you know, code of conduct that the WGA has put out. They're not going to be taking packaging fees. They will not have any affiliate productions or affiliate production companies. It's the biggest agency so far to say, okay, we will we'll agree to this. Although, keep in mind, Abrams Artist Agency is probably in the mid to low tier of
so they're agencies. Not doing packaging. I mean, sure, they do packaging. Even for a mid-tier company, no. I mean, affiliate production company is one thing.
I would not be shocked. If you told me that Abrams does not package anyway, I would not be shocked.
Why would they not? I mean, isn't that just something everybody does? I can understand not having the ability or not having enough players to be able to do it.
That's really what it amounts to.
So they're not in that game. But still, them saying that is a big step.
It's like me saying, you know what, guys? I will not participate in the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. I just won't play. I won't play.
But the point is that we have had 100-plus small agencies sign on and say we're ready to do business. Now we've had bigger ones like Verve and now Abrams Artist Agency stepping up. That's nibbling away at the support of the handful of ones at the top. Those are the big guys. But it hurts when all the people around you, and now some of them are starting to sign clients and say, all right, now I've got a new client because I'm ready to play. So going back very quickly, the WGA said, all right, let's do direct discussions with the top agencies. Well, they all refused to meet. So then they said, all right, we'll offer a one-year sunset on packaging. You can do it for one more year until we move to the 10% model. They were like, no, thank you. Some writers have been making noise and wrote a public petition to say, hey, what's our end game? What's our strategy? And now William
Moore, you're beginning to see fractures within the WGA.
Right, though it's not clear that it's any different from any of the other people speaking up. I don't sense any change from the vast majority of people supporting the WGA.
Okay.
These are just 20 writers and not necessarily huge big ones. But then William Morris Endeavor filed an antitrust lawsuit against the WGA, and then boom, UTA joined in, then boom, the CAA joined in.
Which is, by the way, the only way they can do that.
Right. Okay? Otherwise, they would be behaving in antitrust.
Right, exactly. So the only way they could have done that is one of them had to file it first, and then others said, well, rather than file our own antitrust lawsuit, we'll just jump onto yours.
Right. And of course, they would have had no communication, or that would still be an antitrust.
That would be antitrust. Right, right, exactly.
So then the WGA responded with their own cease and desist letter alleging collusion. And now we have the biggest agency yet, Abrams Artist Agency, caving or saying, all right, we can live with these terms. They are not signing the agreement because the WGA proposal has lots of details that haven't been worked out in negotiations, that those things need to be ironed out. And some of them are not acceptable. They're, you know, discussion points and things you say so you can concede them and say, all right, I'll take that off the table. But they are broadly agreeing to the major terms of no packaging deals and no affiliate productions. I'm not sure if there's any issue of not going public or not having, you know, that sort of a Wall Street investment fund for these companies. I'm not sure if that is a sticking point as well, but they are signed on. So this thing is going to go on and on and on.
You know, as we said, it would, by the way. However, I should point out is the fact that the agencies aren't folding at all. They're not even willing to negotiate. That tells you, one, how much money is actually at stake here?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and two, how much they depend on, the agencies depend on that money.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, it's been a decades-long practice, really since the 90s. So we're looking at 20-plus years. So this has been going on a long time. It's really hard to say, well, okay, we'll get rid of something we've done for decades. That's a high bar. So getting Hollywood to change its ways is not easy, which brings us to sexual misconduct. We did get some feedback from people in Europe who said, Lord almighty, what is it with you guys? Sexual misconduct. And those were women.
Yes. That's what shocked me, actually, was besides the fact that people are listening to us, of course. I'm always shocked when I hear that. But that women were saying, look, we get it, but you don't, not every headline needs to be discussed because, and there were reasons for it, but so when they're, you know, big issues, we'll bring them up.
Well, so there's some good news and some bad news, I guess. But screenwriter Max Landis He's got a high profile on how he's been accused of rape and sexual assault. Multiple women came forward, two on the record, and he's been immediately dropped by his management company. And there's been more fallout for Bryan Singer. We knew he was dumped from the Red Sonja project, but now it looks like he's been replaced by Jill Soloway of Transparent. That certainly is a telling switch from Bryan Singer to Jill Soloway.
And that's good news for Jill Soloway absolutely. And maybe the project itself.
Of course. But, you know, these people who find themselves on the ropes, they can always take comfort from Mel Gibson. He is fully acceptable again in Hollywood. You know, Hollywood's always ready to forgive, or more accurately, forget and move on and make money.
Yeah, I mean, there are now multiple projects with Mel Gibson, which I guess he's been redeemed in the eyes of the industry. I don't know whether
already been Oscar nominated for director since his scandals. So absolutely, of course, he's redeemed. They're like, so you're anti-Semitic, so you're racist, whatever, no problem.
Well, you know, nobody's going to make a movie with Woody Allen, apparently.
That seems to be, though he's getting ready to make a new one, he says, and there are people who say they will work with him. We'll have to see if that happens, but when they don't get released, that certainly raises the bar. But Mel Gibson has a lot of projects. He's got Emil Hirsch joining him in a drama called Force of Nature. He's got another movie called Waldo with Charlie Hunnam and Dominic Monaghan, and he's directing a remake of The Wild Bunch, which is a dreadful idea, and that's going to star Jamie Foxx, Michael Fassbender, and Peter Dinklage, who presumably had the option of doing anything in the world that he wanted at this stage. So, you know, eventually people will move on.
Well, and I guess I don't know which story you want to cover after this.
What we should have included with the other ones, Warner Brothers has a new CEO replacing Kevin Sugihara and Sarnoff. So that's, another woman taking charge in a major division in Hollywood. That's great to see. And in a similar vein, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has invited 842 new members. Half of them, for the first time, a majority of the women of the invitees are women. 29% are people of color, which means 70% are white. And people have been invited from 59 countries. If everyone on the list accepts and joins, female membership will reach 32%. Which, if you're looking at the top level of Hollywood and the top directors, that's probably better than they're represented in the industry.
Well, I've been traveling, okay? So my mail is on hold, and I've got to admit, Michael, I have not kept up with my email. So I'm just going to assume my invitation is probably waiting for me upon my return or somewhere in my inbox.
When podcasters get invited to join the Academy, that will indeed be a big deal.
Oh, wait, you said big deal. Okay, wait. Let me just scroll down in my notes here, because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Well, we still think turning the sci-fi novel Dune into a feature film is a bad idea. Having seen the first attempt, I can agree with that wholeheartedly.
Well, just because I think it needs more time. And it is two films. I was wrong about that. But I just think it needs like 10 hours, 12 hours, not two, not even four.
Well, and Avengers proved that we're willing to wait 10 years and, you know, see 500 hours of, you know, of a movie.
Exactly.
Look, the fact that the movie's being made, it's not stopping director Denis Villeneuve. I always mess up his name. And it's certainly not stopping Warner Brothers. The film hasn't even finished shooting yet, okay? And they've already sent a TV spinoff straight to series. The series is called The Sisterhood. It's about the secretive female group known, and watch this, Michael, I'm going to get it wrong. It's known as the Ben Gesserit.
Close. How was that? The Bene Gesserit.
darn it. Well, the Bene Gesserit, a power in its own right in the world of Dune, by the way. That's what this the Sisterhood is about. They stand alone, but it's sort of like doing a series about the Vatican. If the Vatican included women with almost supernatural powers dedicated to doing whatever they must to see the universe bending towards a better future, that's what the Sisterhood is about.
Yes.
The show will air on the Warner Brothers streaming service. And my question is, really, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I knew you would have that question. I think it's a big whoop, of course. They think it's a universe, and they're going to do it, by God. God forbid you actually wait for the film to be made and see if it's good and people are excited. You know, there are so many Dune novels now that it is a better universe. When it was the original trilogy or four books by Frank Herbert. After the first one, they're really bad. They are vague, philosophical. You can not make movies out of them, but there's a lot more books by his son following years later. There's like dozens plus, and they are more robust and plot driven. So there is a lot of material to draw on, but you know, they think it's a universe. So it's going to be a series. And so is One Day at a Time. That reboot got rescued by the cable channel Pop. They've got 13 new episodes. And thanks to the headlines, you would have thought they'd ended cancer. Yeah. people were like, yes, yes. I'm like, it's a sitcom. Oh my God.
I did see that was trending on Twitter.
Historic rescue of brilliant. You know, it's like, oh my God, you know, a little bit much. But this, to me, to talk about the power of streaming and how much material these shows are worth, The Office, of course, will be streaming exclusively on NBC Universal when they launch their new streaming service in 2021. It's going to leave Netflix. People believe, with very little facts to back it up, that it's the number one most popular show on Netflix. One outside observer said that was the case, but we don't know that. NBC Universal had to make sure they didn't, you know, screw over their investors and the people who have a piece of the pie. So they claim to have had a full auction and they just happened to win it. Their bid was $100 million a year for 5 years. So starting in 2021, they will pay $500 million for the rights to streaming reruns of The Office, which will also be available on terrestrial cable channels as well. That just seems unbelievable to me.
And Steve Carell said, listen, you can back the fifth money truck up to my 20-car garage.
That, yeah, I guess it's those rare hits. Like, I mean, The Office wasn't even that big a hit, frankly. It wasn't like
No, but
Friends,
you know what's happening? I can tell you what's happening. Mm-hmm. And this is totally anecdotal. However, what I think is happening is people are going through Friends, right? They binge watch Friends. Yeah. And that takes, you know, a good 6 months to a year. And then they start on The Office.
Of
and then
course,
they'll start
absolutely.
On some other thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think that's – I wonder what, you know, if in 5 years it'll even be worth that.
Right,
because
but
everybody
that, yeah,
will
that
have watched
far
it.
Into the future that it's going to be worth that much money, $500 million. Wow.
Well, the New York Times ran a story this week about Amazon's third-party sellers. There are concerns about counterfeit products, which are rampant. Knockoffs used to appear at flea markets. Now, they're available online for unsuspecting customers to purchase. This includes all types of products, but the easiest way to spot the problem is with books. The story looks, and this is the New York Times story, it looks at a number of authors who have found cheap knockoffs of their books, their own books, on sale. Most disturbingly, one writer of The Sanford Guide to Microbial Therapy 2018. That sounds like a really dry read, by the way. This writer discovered cheap knockoffs with hard-to-read numbers or giving confusing or blurry numbers when describing the amount of drugs to administer for various ailments.
Yeah,
this does not sound like a good idea.
This is a handbook for professionals. This is something that, you know, you charge $40, $60, $80, $100 because only people in the industry need it. It's like there are TV repairmen who need certain manuals and guides. This is part of the publishing industry we don't talk about a lot, but people got to buy them every year. You got to have the latest one. You need accurate info, and this sucker is not accurate.
Well, as the Times put it, quote, this is not really negligence on Amazon's part. It is the company's business model.
Ouch!
Yeah. Amazon says it's an absurd charge and they go to extraordinary lengths to fight criminality on their platform. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? Ooh, ooh, can I answer? Can I answer?
Yes.
Okay, I think it's a big deal and here's why. I think what's happening on Amazon recently is Amazon has stopped taking orders from many third-party sellers. And they stopped that because what they realized is those Apple AirPods that are being sold for $30, and you're like, wow, what a great deal. Apple AirPods for $30. And the pictures look just like Apple AirPods. And then you get them, and they look just like Apple AirPods. Down to the case. Yeah, they're not Apple AirPods. They're actually knockoffs. And so Amazon is benefiting from that. And that is what the New York Times is talking about.
Well, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Amazon kind of said, okay, we knew we were going to be called out on this at some point. And so they stopped, you know, a couple months ago, they stopped taking orders from these companies.
What, these companies? You mean ones that they've identified as counterfeiters?
Yes,
well,
exactly.
Well, of course, they always do that, they say. They say, well, once we realize someone is illegitimate, we lock them off. We've got billions of other people willing to use our website, but are they doing it robustly and aggressively?
Yes.
No, they are not.
Well, no. What I mean is they stopped taking, except, you know, if you're like Walmart or something like that. If you're a third-party supplier like that, yeah, they're still, you know, letting you.
But they don't take orders. They use the platform, you mean. Yeah, they don't take orders from them. So you're saying they're removing every third-party person that they don't know is legit?
Well,
that's not happened. For sure.
What used to happen is Amazon would order all of this stuff from these
third parties. They don't
order things. No, they do, actually.
No. These are third-party people using the Amazon platform to sell their own stuff. This is not about them getting things from third-party companies and Amazon selling them. This is people using their platform. I am a seller, and I use the Amazon platform. I'm not pretending to be Amazon. Nobody thinks I'm Amazon. I'm a third-party person, and I ship the stuff myself, or sometimes, if I'm big, they get you to keep them at their warehouse. But basically, it's third-party people selling them as Michael Giltz's stuff. It's not Amazon. They're not buying stuff from me.
Okay,
I'm
just using their platform. That middle tier there that you just said, they get them to keep them at...
Only for big people.
And it wasn't only for big people. And what Amazon said is, we're no longer going to be basically placing orders to keep stuff at our warehouse and then we'll ship them for you. We're no longer going to do that.
They still do that. They absolutely still do that. That is not true. Maybe for a certain company they've stopped that, but they absolutely still do that. That's part of their in-time service. They absolutely still demand. Not only do they do it, but they demand people do it because they want to be able to ship stuff right away. So people have to build stuff, create it, send it to Amazon at their own cost, and then Amazon is ready to ship it out. And if they don't use it, they ship it back at your cost. So it's all the onus is on the third party people. So no, Amazon absolutely does that, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about Michael Giltz posting on Amazon, I've got stuff to sell, and it's counterfeit. And Amazon doesn't deal with me. They don't care because they get a cut of the commission. They get a cut every time a deal is made. They're just the platform, but they make money. And more business is done via third-party people than Amazon itself. The majority of the business on Amazon now is third-party sellers. It's not Amazon as a middleman buying stuff from them. No. It's third-party sellers selling directly to consumers using Amazon as a platform. And the problem is they don't care whether you're a counterfeiter or not. They're making money, whether it's legit or not, and they just don't care. And that's what's biting them in the ass. And it's part of the reason these stories are coming out is because when there's a Democrat in power, there's going to be a lot of antitrust going around and people are laying the groundwork to say, look at the criminality, look at the damage they are doing to the economy. And this is one very good example of it.
And actually, I think it was May 7th of this year that Amazon said that third-party sellers are growing at a faster rate than its first-party business.
The growth rate is not what I'm talking about. A majority of the sales on Amazon are now from third-party sellers. I've seen that figure before. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm pretty confident I'm not.
Well, you know, we got a little off topic. That's my fault. But
no, that was a topic. That was a topic. It's a complicated issue.
Well, so are counterfeits hurting the publishing industry? Of course. Whatever sales are at, if people are buying counterfeit, sales should be higher, right? It's like the doofuses who insisted pirated movies actually encouraged people to go to the movies, which, by the way, in regards to Twilight, that is true at least for myself. I saw at least one Twilight movie because I saw a bootleg.
You saw Twilight and then decided I want to see more?
I saw the first one, and then I went to see the second one, and then went, oh, yeah, no, I don't want to see any more of this. Okay, anyway, some more numbers are in for publishing, and in North America, sales were down again for 2018 by 1.6%. However, sales in the trade division were mostly up.
And that's the world you think about, like Stephen King, John Grisham. That's stuff you walk into a bookstore and buy. That's what we're talking about.
Right. Now, the ebook slide seems to have bottomed out, and audiobooks continue to show huge growth, along with religious publishing. The real hurt in the publishing industry came from the professional segment, which was down 8%, academic, which was down 7%, and textbooks for pre-K through 12th grade, which was down 4%. You know, I'm not buying those books anymore at all. So I think, yeah, of course they're down. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Now, the professional segment, we explained trade is the stuff you buy in a bookstore, new bestsellers. The professional segment is highly specialized texts used in industries like accounting, medicine, psychology, computer science, books like The Sanford Guide to Microbial Therapy. They're often highly priced and essential for the user. You got to buy them. So that being down tells you people are making stuff available online. People are finding other ways. And academic and grade school and high school, same story. More and more states are insisting schools adopt open source books or make them available free because there's no reason to have to buy a new math book for third graders every year. So, you know, that's a long-term trend.
I like it when schools use a textbook that I myself could go in and edit at will.
Add fun new facts.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of women, by the way, we talked about women earlier. Women with supernatural powers.
I think that was Amazon, a reference to Amazon.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, Celine Dion, She sure can hold a note, can't she? Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes really long, like 30, 40 seconds. And by the way, she's delivered a serious note to Vegas. And I mean banknotes, by the way. It seemed strange when Dion headed to Vegas for a residency when she was, and is, a huge touring draw all over the world. But Dion and her late husband and manager knew the world would actually come to her. Multiple residencies followed, and now she's finally calling it a day. After generating some $680 million in total box office in Las Vegas. Elvis Presley and others upended Vegas before, but Dion really opened the floodgates for major acts to see Vegas in a new way. Think about Elton John and now Sting is headed there. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, Britney Spears, Janet Jackson, she really did transform that platform into something new, and a lot of people have stepped in after her. So it really turned out to be a very significant move. They built a whole theater for her. It was very risky. You had to know she would draw people, but to draw that well and that long really changed the ideas of what artists can and should do. Hey, why not sit around for a year and have them come to me? It's easier.
Well, you know, I know people who went to see her.
I saw her.
Three times, okay? However, the first two times, first time they went, they show up at the Coliseum there at Caesar's Palace. Yeah, she canceled.
Well, she did not cancel a lot, so that's just bad luck. She was not known. She's not known for canceling lots of shows. She's a
second time she canceled.
That's very rare. That's very unusual. They just got really, really bad luck. She did have a newborn kid. That was one reason she wanted to be there, so she could keep her kids around with her in a more easy, stable environment. You know, she had like a tunnel leading right to her apartment from the theater. You know, it was a crazy setup. But no, she's not known for canceling lots of shows. That's not Celine Dion.
Well, okay, this next story. Does J.J. Abrams have the power of the, let's see if I can remember this, Bene Gesserit?
Close, the Bene Gesserit.
Yeah, those guys, or gals. Does he have that power on his side? Because after being courted by all and sundry and producing and directing powerhouse, the producing and directing powerhouse chose to sign a new big deal with, drumroll, please, Warner Media.
Ah!
Warner Media. Yeah, that's right. The studio and streaming service determined to keep some big talent in-house as the demand for TV ratchets up. Abrams reportedly wanted a full-service home for movies and TV and streaming and everything. Abrams, of course, will also continue his long-term relationship with Disney via Star Wars and Paramount via Star Trek. He's literally getting the best of three worlds. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. You know, we knew it was going to go somewhere, and I think it was a smart choice in terms of, again, not having all your eggs in one basket. Like you say, he's got a big relationship with Disney and a big one with Paramount. It's not as robust as everything he's doing for Warner Brothers, but it lets everybody know other people want and need him, and he's a big player, and so you can't take him for granted. And if there's a regime change, you don't suddenly find yourself on the losing end of a stick. But there you go. I think it was an interesting, smart move. I would not have wanted to go to Disney and put even more power in one boss. So I think it was the right thing to do.
Yes, I would agree with that. Now, it's the summer, by the way, Michael, in case you're wondering, and tourists are in New York City, and they all want to see a Broadway show. Both Michael and I predicted Beetlejuice would get the best bounce from its performance on the Tony Awards. We thought that came off the best. We didn't catch any report on box office sales the day after the show aired, but we can say that Beetlejuice just recorded its highest grossing week yet and almost joined the Million Dollar Club, hitting $980,000. Also, Hadestown is an out-and-out smash hit a la Come From Away. It's been a big seller from day one, despite no big stars or pre-sold storyline, and that's continued. Like the Book of Mormon, it's making the most of its smaller house by practically doubling the top ticket price the day after it won the award for Best Musical. Meanwhile, To Kill a Mockingbird broke the $2 million barrier, becoming only the second play ever after Harry Potter to do so. And creators used to think making a movie would kill a live show. Not anymore. With Aladdin, the latest example. The film just passed $800 million at the box office. We talked about it. But the show, the musical, hasn't missed a beat, grossing about the same as it would, or the same as it was 1 year ago. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. We know the power of the Tonys to sell people. I don't think it had much of an impact on Beetlejuice because we would have heard about ticket sales. We didn't hear about ticket sales for any show, but it doesn't mean it hasn't been a good season. And like we say, we've got three really good hits that are going to run for a while, like Ain't Too Proud to Beg and Hadestown and To Kill a Mockingbird. But, you know, as soon as the Tonys happened, lots of shows post closing notices. They think, oh, dear God, please let me win. Maybe that will save me. And it never happens. So closing in recent weeks, King Lear and All My Sons, though those were both limited runs, no matter how well they did, Cher, the musical, the Cher show is what it's officially called, The Prom, which really had high hopes that maybe it would become the underdog winner, Be More Chill, which we knew was going to go, King Kong, Gary, a sequel to Titus Andronicus starring Nathan Lane, Hillary and Clinton, a new play by Lucas Hanath, and Kiss Me, Kate, also technically a limited run, though if it had done great, it would have kept on running. So lots of shows closed in recent weeks, but we can see from the Tony Awards that a lot of shows this season came out there and are going to run for a long time. More Tony fallout. James Corden wasn't the problem, but hosting the show and all that dead material that they had did not play well. The Emmys may go host-free as well. The Oscars did fine without. Tonys did not do great with a host, and now the Emmys may go host-free. We may be entering the era of no hosts. It could happen.
Wait a second. I don't like that.
I don't either.
I mean, especially given what we're doing right now.
Exactly. There goes another paycheck. And then some shows that are still running. Waitress is at 1,300-plus performances. It's now the longest-running show in history at the Brooks Atkinson Theater. That has now passed a play called Same Time Next Year, which ran for over 3 years in the 1970s. So it took 40 years, but now Waitress has passed to become the highest running show in history at that particular theater. It's 71. It's the 71st longest running show in Broadway history. It's in the top 100 list. That's great. And yet, shows these days run for so long now that it's only the 9th longest running show currently on Broadway. There are 8 shows that have been on Broadway longer than this show, which is way up on the list of the longest running shows in Broadway history. That tells you how long shows are running for. So all those shows are closing, but believe me, all those houses are in demand because there's a long waiting list of shows waiting to come to Broadway.
Yeah, that's actually one of the biggest problems some producers face now is finding the Broadway stage.
Finding the right one. They also won't have to worry about musicians. We talked about the musicians local, the Broadway local 802. They did sign a new deal with the Broadway League, really strong increases in their pay. It's the largest in 20 years, a big chunk going to their healthcare contributions, a new 401k plan. And yes, there was a little kerfuffle about orchestrators also working the pit, and they've worked that out.
Okay, well, are they accepting applications? Because, you know, I could use a raise.
Can you play the triangle?
Yeah, and the cymbals. At the same time, in fact. Put the cymbals on my knees and I can... Yeah, anyway. Man, let me tell you something, Michael. Streaming can really bite you in the ass.
Ouch.
Trust me. Best-selling author Linda Fairstein had a long, distinguished career before turning to crime fiction. At Manhattan's District Attorney's Office, she helped pioneer the Sex Crimes Unit, prosecuting successfully the Preppy murder case. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Among many others. It inspired other cities to set up sex crime units and inspired the Law & Order SVU series. Many considered Fairstein a feminist icon, but she was also involved in the Central Park 5 travesty, a case where 5 kids who happened to be in Central Park on a given night they were railroaded into confessing to a brutal crime on a given night. It eventually fell apart, but not after their lives were destroyed and Donald Trump turned the sordid affair into a boost for his national profile. I remember that. I mean, I lived through this in New York City at the time. Now, long after lessons should have been learned, Fairstein continued to insist their confessions were not coerced. She had managed to put the case somewhat behind her after becoming a best-selling crime author. But the Netflix miniseries about this miscarriage of justice put Fairstein back in the spotlight, ironically, with a lauded performance by the college scandal-plagued actress Felicity Huffman, of all people. The miniseries, When They See Us, broke new ground. But reading about something isn't the same as seeing it. Suddenly, Fairstein has been dumped by her publisher, Dutton, and her agent. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but I'm kind of stunned. You know, just no new facts came out, but the miniseries gained attention. People saw it, and suddenly she became persona non grata. I don't know.
What's interesting to me is Ken Burns did a great documentary on this.
Yes.
Same thing. The Central Park Five.
Yes.
Okay.
And it was highly acclaimed and well rated and got lots of attention.
It was really good, and they actually had video footage of the confessions, of the coerced confessions, and you see it happening in the videos, and you're like, wow, yeah, no, I would have agreed to anything at that point. They've been sitting there for 36 hours, you know. Yes, of course they agreed to that. You didn't let them see their parents. They're 15 years old. You're giving them nothing but a soda in 24 hours. You know, I'd agree to having done something I didn't do. And meanwhile, it just goes to show you that nobody watched it.
No, it's not true. It was highly rated. It did terrifically good in the ratings
for PBS. But then why didn't they?
It did create blowback for Fairstein, but again, seeing the personal fictional scenes and seeing it just depicted in that way just has a bigger impact. You know, it's. I agree with you, but something on Netflix reached a lot more people than, you know, PBS documentary. You know, it's a fictional film. But no, it did have blowback. It did create, attention at the time. But she weathered that. I don't know whether it's fair or not, or whether she just messed up this one time, or whether she has a pattern of it. I just got a petition in my email saying, we've got to reopen all her cases to see what's been going on. You know, has she had other travesties of justice? I don't know that she has a track record of bad, you know, railroading of people. Clearly, she messed up on this case. There's no question about that. But I'm shocked that her publisher and her agent have dumped her, kind of, frankly. I don't know whether it's right or wrong, but I'm just surprised.
You know, and this was a huge case in
Yeah, it was a monster. I don't think it was the 80s. It was the 90s, I think.
No, it was the 80s, because I was still in high school.
But I was in New York when it happened, wasn't I? Okay, I guess you're right.
I tried to talk, by the way, about the Billboard album charts and how getting a high ranking is all about concert tickets and merchandise. But Michael didn't listen.
Nope.
Yeah. You know who did? DJ Khaled. After the New York Times did a story showing how album sales have more to do with sales of artist-branded hoodies than actual albums, Khaled got peeved. Okay? And actually, by the way, that was the story I was quoting. The Billboard formula is always a little opaque, so competitors can't imitate them, and artists can't game the system. Nonetheless, DJ Khaled believes he should have had a number one album recently, but was unfairly kept out of the top spot by Tyler, the Creator, and Billboard's unfair formula. Khaled says, not being number one costs him real money in terms of his brand, future earnings, and the like, and he's suing to prove it. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop because it's going to be impossible to put a number on what he lost by not having a number one album. So that's a really tricky case, but it is fascinating, and if it opens up some more sunlight into what's going on, that'll be good. But I think our solution is best. Stop placing the emphasis on sales. The action is on streaming. That's where it needs to be. But that said, Madonna did notch her ninth number one album. That's pretty historic. Only Barbara Streisand has had more number one albums among female artists, with 11. Springsteen and Bastille also debuted in the top 10. But most of that stuff, you know, in the old days, it would come from sales. And for these older artists, it still comes from sales. Most of Madonna's action and getting on the top of the charts happened because of sales. But that just tells you they're older demos and the people who listen to them aren't as young and always streaming. So it's confusing and different, but it goes back and forth. But Madonna and Springsteen, they shared the charts back in 1985, 34 years ago, when he was at number one with Born in the USA and she was at number two with Like a Virgin. She finally got her revenge. She's finally on top. And Old Town Road is number one for the 13th week in a row. And happy Pride Day to Lil Nas X, who came out at the end of June. Good for him.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we're talking about this blockbuster New York Times story.
Oh my gosh, that's right. Breaking news. A fire at Universal Music, this is a nightmare, has destroyed hundreds of thousands of masters, including priceless recordings by Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong, Bing Crosby, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, Joni Mitchell, Ray Charles, so many more, going right up to the current days with Aerosmith, REM, The Police, Elton John, Eminem, The Roots, the place is in flames. It's a disaster. We've just learned about this in the New York Times. Oh, wait, it happened in 2009. So there was this blockbuster story in the New York Times, I think about 2 weeks ago now, which talked about this fire that took place at the Universal Studios theme park in 2009, but it was involving a warehouse that they used as an archival place. New York Times, in this story, revealed the extent of the disaster for the first time and painted a devastating picture of Universal's actions. They dismissed the fire in the press back in 2009. They said the warehouse only contained some prints of movies. No musical recordings were lost at all.
I remember everybody breathing a huge sigh of relief because this was a giant fire.
Right. But in private emails and court testimony quoted by the New York Times when the studio was fighting over insurance claims, they hinted at the sweeping financial and, yes, cultural loss. Well, the article prompted a fiery response from Universal. That's for you, Sperling. A bad joke. Fiery. Which said the police was...
Wait a second. You made a bad joke and then you blamed it on me? I didn't even make the bad joke.
I did it for you.
Oh, okay.
Which said the piece was riddled with inaccuracies, but of course they couldn't be bothered to tell what those inaccuracies were. And now, in completely unrelated news, Vivendi is now delaying their plans to sell off a chunk or all of Universal Music.
It just goes to show you, like, how hard it is to track masters.
Well, that's part of the disaster. You know, this we're talking about 2009, and I suppose I shouldn't be shocked, but I really am, because it's been at least 30, 40 years of 2000. It's been at least three decades that they should have known this stuff is worth a lot of money. You know, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, it's hard to know. Oh my God, they threw away all those silent films. They erased all those TV episodes. They just taped over them. They threw stuff in the dumpster. You know, you could just go dumpster diving in at studio lots and find old prints, props, all this stuff that they just dumped and threw away. And you think, how could they? But we'll grant them that they didn't recognize or think about the future. But come the 1980s, with VHS tapes and then compact discs for music and laser discs and DVDs and Blu-rays for movies, suddenly you realized, hey, guess what? There's a whole big new market for all this stuff we've got. You've got box sets of music. You've got movies coming out that came out 40 years ago and people are spending millions of dollars to get them. They were making more money on DVDs than they were at the box office. So nobody has an excuse for not recognizing. Forget the cultural importance, which should break your heart alone. This is a lot of money. And even if you don't think it's worth any money, it's some obscure artist, archive it, save it in four spaces, digitize it, find out what you've got, get it available on streaming, because otherwise, why aren't you making any money on it?
I can't believe you just used four spaces on this podcast.
Sorry about that.
No, I don't care.
The original New York Times story sent shockwaves through the industry. It really did. Many acts who had previously wondered about the status of their own masters, like Steely Dan, had been in the dark, you know, and as some people said, you know, Ben Montent.
Not really in the dark since there was a fire. Yeah. Hey!
Ben Montent of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers said, a master, an audio master is like a painting. That's the work. That is the work of art. You're in the presence of the artist. It's not just the best copy. It is the thing itself. There is nothing else except that master. And, you know, what really drove me nuts, I'll let you talk in a second. In an attempt at damage control, Universal Music spoke to Billboard magazine and they lied repeatedly. They lied. Billboard should not have let them get away with this junk, just as they lied in 2009. Here's the first sentence of the article. For much of last week, Universal Music Group archivist Patrick Krause sent members of his team into the 10 vaults the company keeps around the world to verify the location and condition of its more than 3.5 million assets, from original session recordings to photographs, end quote. Guess what? That's impossible. That's a joke. That's ridiculous. They don't even know half the stuff they have in there. You cannot conceivably check up on the location and condition of 3.5 million assets in a week. It doesn't happen.
I do it all the time.
And so that is a bloody lie. And that was what Billboard led with. Later, Krause said, okay, some masters were lost to Billboard, but nowhere near what the New York Times claimed. And they'd been clear at the time in 2009 about the loss. But at the time, Universal Music, as New York Times quoted in that piece, they said no music masters were lost. None. Zip. Zero. Nothing music related was lost. They lied.
Well, lawyer said, look, nobody can sue us about this because the masters, we actually own them.
Well, no, okay, this isn't their lawyers. This is outside lawyers.
Oh,
right. They're
really?
Saying, what is the impact of this story? And a third party lawyer said, well, you know, it's not your stuff. You're the artist, but you don't own that master. It's not yours. It's Universal Music. They can do whatever they want with it.
Well, Michael, I guess I didn't realize whose lawyer said you couldn't sue, but I've been traveling. So, Michael, why don't you tell me and our listeners exactly what's going on, because I do remember this article. It was in the New York Times Magazine, which I brought with me and have yet to read.
Well, it's fun because a couple back and things have happened since the article came out, including the fact that a few days ago, the New York Times came out with a new expanded list of artists who were probably affected by this fire. Their original list of some of the biggest acts of all time included like 100 people. Now it's up to 700 artists. It's really shocking and upsetting. It's like watching the Metropolitan Museum of Art go up in flames. And it was so unnecessary. That's what's upsetting. But first we were told, well, no one's going to sue. And then immediately a class action lawsuit was filed. then we were told in other stories, well, the masters belong to Universal Music. But then other people point out, you know what? Actually, no, because guess what? As we've been discussing on this show, artists are able to reclaim their music after 35 years. And we're in the midst of that process because that happened in the 1970s, a law that was passed. And now in the mid 2010s, all these acts are negotiating. So even if they don't reclaim their masters, even if they re-sign with a label, guess what? Those masters are a part of the negotiating process, and the labels knew acts had the right to reclaim them. So if they were negligent in any way and have lost irretrievable, irreplaceable material, that's going to cost them money. So that's a big issue. And outsiders said this has nothing to do with the value of Universal Music. So what? They lost some old tapes, an alternate take, whatever. It's not going to stop Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World from, you know, being played on streaming services.
Well, but here's my question. Mm-hmm. So, okay, let's go down that road for a second. Okay. It's not an Old Town Road either. Hey! Okay, so Louis Armstrong, one of my favorites. Okay? Love Louis Armstrong. And my question would be, is that master of What a Wonderful World in that vault that got destroyed, was the master destroyed? Because if so, then the only thing we have to go off of is the CDs that have been mastered already.
Well, there are always copies of copies. So the best available archive of a music is not necessarily the original master, even if that's still around. But the easiest answer is that nobody knows and nobody will ever know what was lost in that fire because none of it was well cataloged. Nobody, no record label is doing a good job. Absolutely, music by Louis Armstrong was lost, and not just masters, but alternate takes and archive material, photos, video. Brian Adams, the, you know, cuts like a knife. Brian Adams wanted to do a 30th anniversary release of his album Reckless, which sold like 12 million copies worldwide, a big smash hit. And he was reaching out to the label and they just kept being vague and wouldn't tell him. You know, he said, couldn't figure out what was going on. He could never make it work. He had to make do. They had nothing to offer him. And he didn't know why. Now he knows why. Richard Carpenter of the Carpenters, one of the most valuable catalogs of all time, he was set to go into the studio and do remastering of all their albums, all their music. The label kept dragging their heels. It wasn't until he booked studio time and was in the studio waiting for the masters to arrive that they finally told him they weren't available. We may have lost all of their archival material, all their master recordings. So maybe sometimes a second master or a second copy is made and that's not played as much. And the original master is used to make lots of LPs. And so that gets worn down. So there's all sorts of questions about what's the best available source of the music. That's why it's so important to archive and catalog it. And I think the biggest takeaway is, you know, they said nothing. This has nothing to do with the value of Universal Music. A, they got $150 million back from the insurance companies. And B, that really shows a very unintelligent understanding of the industry, of the entertainment biz. We know how valuable prints of old movies are. We know how valuable old TV shows are. We should understand by now how valuable all that music is. Forget the cultural history of it, which is upsetting. Anybody not doing a good job of archiving their stuff, which is every single record label that's around, they are costing themselves money. They are being irresponsible with the jewels, the only assets that that company has, which is their music. So it's very upsetting. We have no idea what's going on and what's been lost. But until we keep hounding them and make sure they start archiving properly and really spend, it's going to be done in a week, unlike Universal Line. It won't be finished in a week. It'll take years just to figure out what they have in all the different areas and to try and decide what's the best way to preserve them, what's the best way to present them to the world, what should they be available on streaming, and move forward. But those are assets, and those can be exploited if you want to hear the business angle on it, and they are dropping the ball.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I know archiving from a visual standpoint, right? You know, I know
very, very challenging. It's extremely challenging and expensive.
It's an art form. It is a craft. It is an art form. There are people that do it. They know. I mean, I go to these conventions. You know, unfortunately the acronym has escaped me, but I've been to they hold an annual and biannual, like two conventions a year. And they're very dry. Not all of them are. Not all of the seminars are very interesting, and you really have to know your stuff to sit through them and actually get anything out of them. But it's very technical work.
Yeah, but it's essential. You know, you are sitting on Tutankhamun's tomb. You are sitting on the crown jewels, and you can't be bothered to lock the door or even figure out what you have, and you're letting it, you know, slip down the drain. To use 14 bad mixed metaphors, but it's money, and they are pouring it away. It's a disaster. So there's really no forgiving it. It's really hard and challenging and very, very expensive. But what the hell else are you spending your money on if not preserving and archiving the music that you make all your money on?
Let me ask you this. Those mixed metaphors you just used.
Mm-hmm, I love them.
What would Judith Krantz say as a writer?
She loved mixed metaphors. It's time for our obituary section. And one of the people who died over the last few weeks is best-selling author Judith Krantz. She died at 91. You probably recognize your name, even if you haven't read one of her 10 books. She just published 10 novels. I was a little surprised in this day and age when, you know, James Patterson puts out one book a month and Danielle Steele recently ramped up and is doing like 6 books a year, which is a huge leap up for her. It's kind of funny to hear about an author who wrote 10 books over a 20-year period, but that's Judith Krantz. She was very successful as a journalist. Perhaps her most famous article was The Myth of the Multiple Orgasm, written for Cosmo in 1972, which Sperling said, finally, thank God.
Well, very
funny. You get the joke? Thank you very much.
I just got that. Although back in 1972, that was like, oh, shocking.
Yes, no, it is, but thank God it's a myth, Sperling said. It's not all on me.
Yes,
Her husband kept pushing her to write a novel, saying she was a natural storyteller. And she finally did, writing her first novel, Scruples, and getting it published the same year she turned 50. So talk about a great second act. In 4 months, it hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list. She wrote 9 more novels and basically sold about 80 million copies worldwide. And you can sum them all up with sex and shopping. She likes sex and she likes shopping. They were insanely detailed on the products and things and where people shopped and what they bought, to the point that in her first book, the heroine wears a pair of 11-carat diamond earrings. Later in the book, she screwed up and referred to them as 9 carats each, which brought 450 readers to take the time to write a letter, a physical letter, and mail it to her saying, what's going on here? Are they 11 carats or 9? Dude, that's an outrageous mistake. In comparison, in a later book, Princess Daisy, she said World War II began in 1940, which prompted all of one letter. nobody noticed. Nobody cared. So successful, yes. Good, not particularly, but she didn't care.
Well, you know, and I know that when we do the obituaries, we try to have a personal kind of bent here. Well, Sylvia Miles, I can tell you, I do have a personal story about. And when I lived in New York, and I would sometimes, when I was working for studios, I would get invited or maybe happen to know when the Academy screenings were. Okay, so, you know, at the end of the year, they hold these Academy screenings so that Academy members can see all the films. And back then, they didn't have screeners that they could send to everybody.
Right, and they'd have food and wine as well, too.
None of the ones I went to had food and wine.
Okay.
They were like, hey, here's a screening room. There's the movie. Good luck.
Yeah.
But almost inevitably, everyone I went to, every single screening I went to, who would show up? Sylvia Miles.
Yes,
and I would say, who is this person? Well, I was told she was an Oscar nominee for Midnight Cowboy and Farewell, My Lovely. And I said, what? What scene was she in? What role did she play? And so I would watch these movies just to see her scenes. And she kind of did steal the scene she was in.
Oh, absolutely. A good actress. She died at 94, and she certainly was a 2-time Oscar nominee. But if you lived in New York City, she was a mainstay, not just screenings, but every party, every opening, she was there. She showed up, she was there, and she was in most of them because she would show up for anything to get the free food and wine and just to be seen and photographed. And the publicist appreciated it because sometimes it's hard to get anybody to show up. So at least he got Oscar nominee Sylvia Miles cutting a rug, looking, you know, looking memorable and ready to give a quote. So then when the big stuff happened that maybe you didn't need her for, you still let her in because she was, you know, a mainstay for you. She was dependable. So she was just, I don't think she ever bought food. She just worked at every party. God bless her. She was a character.
That's kind of what she was known for.
Oh, I absolutely. Mean, yeah.
Oh, gosh. Well, and then Franco Zeffirelli passed away at the age of 96.
Oh, God. Stop me. Stop me. He's so fascinating. His life is so much interesting than his work.
But I know.
He is a mess. Just we're way long. Go to the notes that we have. Check out some of the factoids I brought up about him because he's had a crazy mixed up and at times hateful. I mean, he's assaulted numerous men and multiple people have come forward very convincingly, including actor Jonathan Schaich talking about him. He's a bad person, messed up, self-hating homosexual, friend of the far right, but he's a character. He's colorful. That's for damn sure. And if he's remembered for one thing, it's maybe his opera work that may have been good. I never got to see it. And his Oscar-nominated film, the 1968 Romeo and Juliet, important for starring age-appropriate teens. He said, you know what? They're supposed to be teenagers. Let's cast teenagers. And they cast Olivia Hussey and Leonard Whiting, each one of which was more beautiful than the other. They were just stunningly beautiful. And he had one through line for the movie. You know, you have a certain idea, you know, what you want to do, what's going to drive your interpretation of this play. His was, yeah, they're in love. They really want to have sex. These kids are burning with desire. Let's remember that. And this movie is one of the most erotic films you'll ever. They're like, they want to have sex and you want them to have sex because they're so beautiful. It's a very sexy, you look at Baz Luhrmann's movie, that is romantic. This one is sexy. It's a good, solid film.
Don't tell me how it ends.
I won't tell you how it ends. And his operas were accused of being overly lavish in their set design and their costumes. To go overly lavish in opera, that's really difficult to do. So they must have been crazy over the top.
Well, you know, I was actually a little shocked at when I saw that you had included an obituary of Ma Rainey.
That's right.
In the notes, I thought, wait.
What? Isn't she dead?
I was like, hasn't she been dead for years?
That's right. But the New York Times has this great ongoing column where they rectify the wrong of people they ignored at the times they died. So there are a lot of women and people of color get included in Overlooked, which is in a recurring New York Times section where they do an obituary, an appreciation of someone's life and career that they let slip through the cracks the first time. It's a great ongoing series. You should check it out. And I thought Ma Rainey was a great one to do that with because she died at about the age of 53. We're not sure how old she was, but she was a trailblazing bisexual blues singer. Yes, she died in 1939, the greatest year of movies in all time. And it's really worth checking out. You should check the link in our show notes. And we should thank our listener, Noam Christopher, for sharing that link with us. I might have missed it, actually. He sent it to us via email by sending us a link at dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
So you can also call
and leave us a voicemail. You can call 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263 and leave us a voicemail. You can follow us on Twitter where our handle is @showbizsandbox. And of course, we're on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can like our page there. That information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com, which, by the way, is where you will find all of the ways you can subscribe to our show. And you can subscribe in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, Google, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You should be able to find us. You should be able to rate and review us. We do appreciate it when you do. It does help us out when you do. It helps others find the show when you rate and review us. So thank you for doing that. Again, all that information is on showbizsandbox.com, our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have their own website. It is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's freethe800.com.
Wow, you're going to have to go back about 3.5 hours to the beginning of the show to figure out what that means.
How's this one then? Sexandshopping.com. That's okay. Easy to remember.
Yeah, it's also like about only like 10.5 minutes in it. Well, you know what? If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on either one of those websites, one of which I actually do believe probably exists, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated.
Is there a show next week?
There is a show next week.
Yay! Yes. Success of freedom, America, 4th of July, a new episode. Good to know.
So again, michaelgiltz.com, some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.